Welcome, welcome, Mush fam, to another episode of Mushroom Revival Podcast. We're a podcast dedicated to bridging the gap between you, our lovely dedicated listeners, and the wonderful, wacky world of fungi. Today, we have an exciting episode with Sue Van Hook. She is a great mycologist in the mycological world, and we're really happy to have her on the show.
Sue Van Hook is a mycologist, naturalist, teacher, and healer. She's been studying the taxonomy and ecology of fungi for the past 45 years, having begun her coursework in the Pacific Northwest, where the mushroom season lasts 9 months out of the year. She completed her undergraduate and graduate degrees in botany and mycology at Humboldt State University under the tutelage of Dr. David L. Largent. For 18 years, she taught biology and environmental science at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs. While at Skidmore, she served as a mycological consultant to Ecovative for the first 3 years before becoming the full-time mycologist at the company. In her retirement, she consults and teaches about fungi.
Okay, so thanks for being on our show, Sue. And you've been studying fungi for the past 45 years. That's a really long time and more than most of us. Could you tell us what got you into mycology?
I sure can. I think I have to back up to summers on an island in Maine growing up with my mom and grandparents. And we spent the entire day outdoors, lobstering, fishing, clamming, berrying, foraging, and mostly exploring. The love of nature from that experience as a child is very deeply seated in my soul. So being outdoors is number one, I think, element of my connection to the fungi. Then I took my first botany class at Humboldt State University with Dave Largent in 1974 in the spring. And I did very well in the class. And he sort of took a liking to me and said, why don't you take my fleshy fungi course this fall? So I did. And our assignment was to come in back with 20 fruiting bodies of different species every week, and we would learn gradually. So the first week, I brought in 20 specimens, most of which were round oak galls that had fallen off the oak leaves to the ground, and I thought they were puffballs. And when I opened up my specimens in lab that week, he was absolutely shocked. The shock on his face was just visible, and I was like, uh-oh. He couldn't believe I did so poorly. So he said, how about we go out on Saturday? And he took me into the redwood forest behind the college on Saturday and just helped train my eye to fungi so that I learned a new search image. And now it's like ridiculous because I'll be walking with friends, having a conversation on a hike or, with family members, and I see fungi everywhere out of the periphery of my vision. And have to, of course, stop and take a look. So I went from having no search image to having a very well-developed search image. And then from then on, I took every mycology course offered at Humboldt State. So general mycology, microscopic fungi, forest pathology, advanced mycology. And even I went on in the summers to the biostation at University of Montana's Flathead Lake biostation. And I studied with Orson Miller, and I studied with Mason Hale, who was the lichenologist at the Smithsonian and the author of the How to Know the Lichens book. So those 3 summers that I spent there were some of my most memorable times with fungi and lichens. We were going on field trips every day to Glacier National Park. We went up into Canada to Banff and Jasper, to the Mission Mountains. And it was just absolutely idyllic to be out in the field with these incredible experts, a whole bunch of really interested students, and learning fungi hands-on outdoors. I graduated with a double major in botany and French, so I went to Paris to try to study lichens, but I had a nervous breakdown there because it wasn't where I was supposed to be, and in 3 weeks I was gone, and I returned to Humboldt as Largent's grad student, and I did one of a very small handful of ecological studies where I collected 4 hours a day, 6 days a week for 2 years straight, in order to really try to characterize the mushroom flora of a sand dune beach pine ecosystem on the coast, which was a nature conservancy preserve. And it was ideal because it was a protected property. You had to have permission to go there by permit. There was a locked gate. And so I was assured that everything I found was what was actually fruiting. So I could really quantify and identify the fungal flora in its completion. One of the very interesting findings there of that study was the difference in the fungal composition between the first and second years. The first year was very wet season, and the season out there in Northern California lasts from September till May, long rainy season. And both decomposer and mycorrhizal fungi fruited abundantly. The second year was very dry, and I was really quite amazed to find that it was the mycorrhizal species that fruited, and the decomposers didn't show up very much. So several years later, there was a paper that came out of Cornell that reported trees, I think it was mostly maple trees, that would pump water using their tap roots from the groundwater and then release it to the subsurface roots at night, essentially watering their mycorrhizal fungi. So this was like a real aha moment for me, because I went, oh, that's what was happening the second years. The mycorrhizal pines and ericaceous shrubs were pumping the water up and watering their mycorrhizal fungi so that they did fruit even in a dry year.
That sounds really cool. And you have been studying arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi and you know, soil science and how fungi interact with the soil, which is such a juicy topic. And what a lot of ecologists don't truly comprehend on the capacity in which fungi do help our ecosystems and play such a vital role. And what you were just talking about with, it just sounded like a sponge. And there's a phrase, a soil sponge or this soil sponge. Could you tell our listeners what exactly is the soil sponge?
Yeah, it's exactly what I did just describe. And I just learned that term this winter. So you think of it as an actual sponge. So I'm going to ask the listeners to visualize a plate with just a pile of white flour, and then another plate with a piece of whole wheat bread. And we'll take a paper cup and punch some holes in the bottom, small holes, add some water, and then rain down on the pile of flour. What do you expect to see, Alex?
I expect to see the water to run off the powder and absorb into the piece of bread.
Absolutely right. So the question is why?
The structure of the bread and the porosity, you know, it's all combined and there's a lot of little caves for the water to go into, but also the yeast, the fungi in the bread, I guess, would have a role in water absorption.
Absolutely. Yeah, you got it. So this simple little experiment is a really good easy one for anyone to do to demonstrate this principle of a healthy soil sponge. You're right. The yeast is the added ingredient that differs the pile of flour from the piece of bread, right? And then because of the yeast metabolizing the sugars in the flour and creating carbon dioxide, it forms the air spaces within the piece of bread. So both the chemistry that's sticky and the air spaces, the physical air spaces in the bread do hold the water. So it acts like a sponge. And you can rain down on that piece of bread a whole lot longer than you can on the pile of flour without having any runoff occur whatsoever. So this is compared to dirt versus soil. A lot of people don't know the distinction between those two terms. So dirt is basically bare minerals, mineral particles like sand, silt, and clay. And soil has the organic living parts to it. So the bacteria, the fungi, the invertebrates, plant roots, all present. So in a nutshell, that is the soil sponge, is dirt with microbial life.
And I feel like I cheated with that answer a little bit, because I've done this with Nance Clem, and we were taking a master soil and fungi class with Nance Clem and Peter McCloy in Chicago. And she gave that analogy, which is a beautiful, awesome analogy. And, you know, she loves working with kids because, you know, teaching kids about fungi, especially in the United States, is super important because there's a lot of mycophobes. And just telling them that, yeah, the sandwich that you eat, the bologna and cheese or the peanut butter and jelly, like that has yeast in the bread and that has fungi, and getting their hands in the soil and having them feel that sponge and not being afraid of dirt under their fingernails, and just kind of understanding how soil works and all the different microbes and living things living in soil. And it's not just dirt, it's soil. It's living, breathing organisms. So what role do fungi play in creating and maintaining a healthy soil?
Yeah. Nance is awesome, by the way. Nance Clem. So how does this bunch work? So the thing that I just learned, and I am a botanist, is that 40% of the photosynthates made from photosynthesis are shunted to the plant roots. 40%, almost half of what photosynthesis occurs or creates in terms of sugars. And they send these sugars to their roots to grow the roots, obviously, but also to excrete them into the root zone to feed them fungi and bacteria. So the roots themselves are the conduits for the water and nutrients to flow in and the sugars to flow out to feed these fungi and bacteria. The really cool part about this sponge that we're just coming to appreciate and to tie to climate change is that for every gram of carbon that we retain or add to the soil, there are 8 grams of water molecules that can be held. So if you think of carbon as the skeleton of the sponge, even like one of those eco-friendly collapsible sponges, and we add the water, it can hold up to 8 times the weight in water, which greatly expands the soil and greatly holds on to the water.
Yeah. Could you tell us more about arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi and what the differences are between them and all types of mycorrhizal fungi?
Yeah. So there are several types. They fall into 2 basic categories based on where you find the hyphae. So those that form an external sheath outside the root epidermis are characterized as ectomycorrhizae. Those that don't form this external sheath and actually penetrate between cortical cells and into cortical cells of the root are termed endomycorrhizae. These categories are further grouped by host plants. Most ectomycorrhizae are symbiotic with trees and woody shrubs, with an exception of those associated with ericaceous and arbutoid plants, which are the heath family, the blueberries, the huckleberries, rhododendrons and things. Those are endomycorrhizal plants. The endomycorrhizae are typically found in the roots of herbaceous perennials and annuals, crops, grasses, and are essential for germination and growth of orchids and the sugar link to the achlorophyllous plants that lack chlorophyll in the Monotropaceae, which is the family of Indian pipes that is flowering in the woods right now. So the AM fungi are the most primitive group of mycorrhizal fungi, and they really assisted in the movement of aquatic plants onto land. You know, we're talking hundreds of thousands of years ago. So they are ubiquitous. It's easier to define the plant families that lack them than those that have them. And they are most often associated with soils where phosphorus is limiting. So we know now, because of DNA capabilities, that there are over 300 arbuscular mycorrhizal symbionts affiliated with more than 250,000 plant species, which is kind of the number of all the plant species. There really are very few plants that lack mycorrhizal fungi, and many of them have arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. These AM fungi first penetrate the root between the cells, and they sort of form highways or avenues, and then they proliferate into the cells and grow like little mini corals or little small trees, being highly branched. And it's inside the cortical cells where these highly branched arbuscles are the site of the nutrient exchange and sugar exchange. So the fungi is bringing dissolved minerals as nutrients to the plant, and the plant is providing the fungus with sugar as its carbohydrate source. And then in addition, the AM fungi produce spherical vesicles within root cells where they store lipid, and these lipids become really important in nutrition for the plant in times of environmental stressors like drought or a pathogenic attack. They're a very handy extra source of food. These lipids can also survive death of the root and end up as storage units within the soil itself and feed other microbes such as bacteria. So the interesting thing about these primitive AM fungi is that they're the only ones that are non-septate, so they only lay down a septum when they branch, and this means that they contain many nuclei within one cell, indicates their early evolutionary history. And the fine little runner hyphae that extend out from the root from this foothold inside the root cells can reach up to 3 inches away from the root into the soil. The part that's so fascinating is that the extent of these fine filaments that we cannot see amplify the access to water and nutrients 100 times compared to just plant roots alone. So they really, really are important in the water balance, the nutrient scenario for keeping our plant communities healthy and functioning.
Yeah, mycorrhizal fungi are pretty incredible. And just the research into not only mycorrhizal, but endophytic fungi and how fungi and plants interact is pretty incredible. We had a guest come on talk about how mycorrhizal fungi in Bhutan was infecting larvae with cordyceps. And that was something that blew our mind. And the extent of how mycorrhizal and different species can switch, you know, in that instance from a symbiotic relationship to a parasitic, or, you know, in the case of shiitake, it switches from a saprophytic to mycorrhizal for orchids, and the extent that these species can go to create symbiosis with plant allies is pretty incredible, and it goes to show what we as humans can do to extend our symbiotic reach to other kingdoms and queendoms. And you were talking about these vesicles or these globules of nutrients or water that they create. Can you talk a little bit more about the importance of glomulin molecule in the soil sponge?
Sure. So this group of AM fungi belongs to a very primitive order called the glomerales, an order within the zygomycete fungi that are non-septate. So they perform the conduction of water minerals for the plant in themselves, and they do it with an excretion of an exudate called glomalin, G-L-O-M-A-L-I-N, it's pronounced differently by different people. And this glomalin is highly sticky. It's a glycoprotein, so it's a sugar protein that they can use to seal off intercellular spaces and almost form cavities that are protected. In addition, this glomalin adheres, is adsorbed onto the mineral particles of soil, clay, silt, sand, to form a sticky surface that then can attract other microbes and then can attract other soil particles and organic matter and other mycorrhizal fungi and create the actual soil aggregate itself. So it glues bare mineral particles together in the soil and forms a whole micro community of organisms in these aggregates. The beauty of this molecule is that it's tenuous. So it's tenuous in its ability to bind things, but it's also tenuous in its lifespan. So this molecule can last up to 42 years in the soil, even when hyphae may die back. So it's a persistent molecule, much as is chitin, the major constituent of fungal cell walls, is also a very sturdy, rigid molecule that persists in the environment. So this translates into one, the ability to hold a polar water molecule to attach to it and then hold on to it. But it also translates to the sequestration of carbon in the soil and a reversal of carbon dioxide concentrations from the atmosphere back into the soil.
Wow, what a productive and celebratory molecule. Why are you excited about this and AM fungi?
I am excited because I have been involved in environmental issues and movements my entire life, since my teen years. And I went to school in Northern California in the heart of the Redwood Forest, and my early battles were to conserve old-growth forests and preserve endemic and endangered flora and fauna on the coast of California. The very first report I remember, I was in high school, on increasing carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere as measured by Charles Keeling at Mauna Loa, 2 miles up in Hawaii, began in 1958. That very first report on increased carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere was presented to President Johnson in 1965 from a newly established science advisory council. It has taken 54 years for the public and the policymakers to accept climate change, to accept increasing warming and the human influence of it. It has been a lifelong endeavor on my part to teach about this and to point out the changes that we are seeing in flora and fauna, you know, the cinnamon chanterelle moving northward, the blue indigo lactarius moving northward, that's common fungi in Tennessee, but it just showed up here in northern New York maybe 7 or 8 years ago. So teaching about these patterns that we're seeing of change and let's doing something about them, I felt very frustrated. I haven't seen a lot of progress. And certainly the climate deniers in this presidential administration has got me even more frustrated. So what I am so excited about this topic is, one, because I'm just learning about it. I spent the winters taking courses from Walter and Alan Savory and Dee Dee Pursehouse. And two, it's a quick fix. It's an actual real solution to rebalancing not only the carbon cycle, but the water cycle is the one that's really out of balance. And we haven't looked at water vapor as the most abundant greenhouse gas, which makes up 95% of greenhouse gas, because it's too complicated to model. And so we've falsely gone off on this tangent of looking just at carbon dioxide emissions and fossil fuel industry, which is, it is true, we have to cut those emissions, but it only contributes 5% to total greenhouse gas. So it should be a parallel track. The real track should focus on conserving water in the soil. And when we conserve carbon in the soil by feeding the microbes and keeping our soils healthy, we then keep the water in the soil and rebalance the water cycle. So it all goes to revegetating the planet. The Sahara used to be lush grasslands. The Middle East was the original Fertile Crescent of agriculture. 40% of the planet is desertified. California will be a complete desert in 10 years. So this is a true reversal that is easy. And it just involves soil health principles of no tilling. Because if we till, we break the miles and miles of fungal hyphae in the soil that are our friends. You know, the good mycorrhizal fungi get disturbed and broken and trashed. No tilling. Keeping the soils covered so that we don't have off-gassing of carbon dioxide, because when there's no cover on the soil, the microbes have nothing to feed them, and so they get rid of their carbon dioxide. So cover cropping, and then increasing the diversity of our crops. So we plant 7 crops at the same field in different heights, and then we bring in grazing, the mob grazing, which was the historic way that animals fed. So we had the grasslands of and savannas of Africa where you might have, herd of elephants or herd of gazelles, and they were controlled by the predators and kept in a small, tight unit. So they would graze as a mob, and they would finish off that area, then move on. And what they left behind was fertilizer, seed source, and aeration of the soil. So they're returning to this old evolutionary principle of mob grazing and finding that on very barren, dry grasslands with just a few tufts of grass, you bring in a mob of cows or sheep or pigs or chickens, and within 2 years you can restore a lush green grassland. When I saw these photos in these courses this winter, my heart just jumped out of my chest. I have 2 new grandchildren and a third one literally on the way in the next 2 weeks. So for the first time I felt like, oh wow, we can do this. We can do this quickly with a reversal of our farm practices, and people are doing it and demonstrating it. And we just have to grow that awareness. So as the hyphae extend, very quickly out into the soil, we can extend that knowledge to the world.
Yeah, thank you for touching on all those points. I think that's incredibly important to kind of specify what we are fighting against. I never liked the term global warming. It didn't sit right, and I didn't think that was what we were really after. And even, you know, you're talking about CO2, and really it's about water vapor, which I think is critically important. And I think bacteria, what we're finding is bacteria and fungi play a vital role in water vapor in our atmosphere, with, you know, the more destructive practices with tilling and with destroying a lot of our cover crops and a lot of our low shrub vegetation, we're killing a lot of this beneficial leaf bacteria and fungi. And, you know, Dr. Money is a researcher who described that spores get drifted up into the atmosphere, as well as some other researchers were describing this certain type of bacteria. Mm-hmm. And they are extremely hydrophilic. So they attract water vapor and make clouds and kind of a barrier for our climate and also helping with the whole water cycle. And the more plants that we're cutting down, the more soil that we're disturbing, we're messing up this vital cycle. And even going beyond the phrase climate change, because I think a lot of our problems go way beyond climate. You know, I haven't come up with a good phrase that has totally sat right with me, but I think it's on a good track. And I think, you know, as you were talking about, CO2 is just a good starting place, and it's only 5%. But, you know, just like peaking an animal, you know, like polar bears or panda bears to pick as the main animal to conserve. It is a lot easier than picking a million things to go after. So I'm really excited. I think you're on the right path, and we are starting to realize, hopefully sooner rather than later, that, you know, a lot of our practices that we are doing are not sustainable, and we have to wake up and get on the right level. And I think this is what fungi have taught us, is symbiosis, and kind of a good lesson that we can gain from, you know, lichen or mycorrhizal fungi, is that we have to be in symbiosis with our ecosystems around us to be living on this planet any longer. And I'm just kind of curious, like, talking more about this symbiosis of humans and our environment, how does a healthy soil sponge tie into improved gut microbiome and gut health?
So one, I have to just acknowledge that I'm in agreement with you, Alex, on symbiosis as a paradigm rather than competition. I know you've heard me speak about that before. In terms of what the path Chuck Darwin set us off on versus Lynn Margulis and the Gaia hypothesis. It all goes back to the soil. FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, said something to the effect in the 1940s about our entire existence depends on the top 6 centimeters of soil, right? So certain people throughout history have understood. Certainly after the Dust Bowl happened and all the, you know, the legislator in Congress was pointing out the window and said, here, let me show you Kansas, as the dust blew across the country to Washington. The soil is everything. And without the soil, the plants can't grow. Without the soil, the fungi have the plant, not the plants to have to feed them, nor to give them organic matter. So our food, as you can imagine, depends on the health of the soil, and nutrient density depends on the fungi present in the soil to convert organic matter as polymers of cellulose and starch and lignin back into their minerals that can then be reabsorbed by the plants and increase the mineral density of our food, so that we have the phosphorus, the sulfur, the nitrogen, the potassium, the magnesium, the, you know, the boron, the cobalt that our body needs to run enzymatically. And so the gut health and the soil health are directly tied together. We also now know, with more and more studies coming out, that almost every illness can be tied to a person's imbalance in their gut. And that we have all this effort going into probiotic diets and supplements that will regenerate our microbiome and maintain our gut health so that we can stay healthy. You know, if our food provided the microbes, we wouldn't have to be taking the supplements. And so once we start to switch back to holistic soil health practices, we can then count on our food to nourish us completely.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we adopt those practices soon, more on a larger scale as well. So we did some digging and found that in the past few months, the PPMs of carbon dioxide have jumped from 410 parts per million to 416 this past week. So with this in mind, do you really believe that we can reverse the parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere within our lifetime?
Absolutely. And I've only come to believe that in the past 6 months.
Wow.
This is a topic for an entire additional podcast. But Walter Yenné, who I've mentioned, the founder of Holistic or Healthy Soils Australia, and Alan Savory of the Savory Institute from Africa, both have demonstrated the rapid recolonization of grasslands within 2 to 3 years in very arid, desecrated soils, incorporating the mob grazing, the no-till, the cover cropping. We need to quit advertising cows as bad, methane producers contributing greatly to the warming. Massive cow operations do contribute to the methane gas, but small, historically grazed livestock are a benefit and necessary for the regeneration of grasslands and our farmland. The AM fungi will also decrease the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere once they are promoted by these practices. So yes, I do believe we can reverse it. And according to Walter, it can be within decades. That to me is promising. I know that he has said that increasing the carbon content of soil just 1%, from 1% to 2%, can do it. That is not a lot. Just think of that. I know Congressman Shelley Pingree has new planks and a platform for the farm bill, for the next farm bill. She was an organic farmer. She has learned about the soil sponge and she gets it. And she in Congress already is promoting this switch. All it's going to take is incentivizing farmers to stop. And it actually can be a weaning off of fertilizers. This is not incompatible with using fertilizers and pesticides. But within a few years, the expenses of farmers will mean less tilling, less running of the tractor, less fossil fuel being burned, less to no fertilizers, pesticides. Those expenses go down. Mob grazing and feeding your animals directly rather than buying feed. And so it's just a win-win-win for farmers. So I think it will be very easy with a couple of incentives, such like paying for cover crop seed, which I know is expensive, modifying farm equipment to be no-till, to handle no-till, and planting in a thatch. With a few little changes like these and tweaks, we could really transform agriculture quickly if we wanted to, if we made up our mind to do that.
Yeah, that's really incredible. And there's so many different facets of, you know, making a positive impact. And again, you know, you're talking about how carbon dioxide was, only 5%. And if we look back at the Carboniferous era, plants were 30% bigger, animals and insects were also about 30% bigger, and things were pretty luscious. And actually, the parts per million were about 800 parts per million, and life seemed to be flourishing. And then there was a huge kind of collapse, especially in rainforests in the Carboniferous era, when the temperatures went down. So it's funny when I hear like global warming, I think it doesn't really capture what the problem is, and what we should really be focusing on. And I think like carbon dioxide is not inherently bad. It's just like it has to be in this cycle, and we have to be looking at our soil health, and do we have healthy soils that can hold the carbon, and do we have cycles in place where all organisms are benefiting, and we're not damaging systems and causing massive cancer to our people and making oil spills and radioactive waste and things like that. So it's really interesting on how this develops and what we choose to focus on in terms of making an impact. And I'm curious, what you recommend people doing and on an individual level to make an impact on our environment, in our society, kind of interpersonally with humans, but also our relationship with Mother Earth and animals and insects and fungi and the climate. What can our listeners do to make a positive impact in our world?
Well, first of all, I try to practice reciprocity with the environment and with nature, and honoring all organisms as I harvest. This year, for the first time, I practiced these soil health principles in my own garden. I did not turn it. I just planted the seed within the mulch that I left behind from last fall. So practicing the soil health principles on your own gardens and small farms is one thing that people can do directly. Supporting other farmers and organic farmers in your community in farmers markets is really important. I think downsizing from massive mega operations to small locally based community operations is the way forward. And so anything you can do to support that. And in addition to that, it's lobbying. It's writing to your congresspeople, to your town counselors. I've been doing a ton of workshops with our Agricultural Stewardship Association locally and in the state of New York with Cornell Cooperative Extension Service to offer workshops just to demonstrate these principles to as many people as wish to attend. And every little time you get one person to see the difference and understand the difference and then go practice the difference, we've made a huge difference.
And what do you think is the future of mycorrhizal fungi and how can they help?
So, this year we're celebrating going to the moon 50 years ago. We have a lot of stuff going around that in the news. And I would say we know more about the moon and its surface than we do about the soil beneath our own feet. Yeah. So, the DNA probes have opened up our understanding of just how many microbes dwell within the soil, right? We can't see most of them, and we can certainly sieve for them and plate them and colonize and count colonies and eventually get identifications the old way. But the DNA probes have greatly quickened that process. So we're starting to be able to understand the complexity. However, the complexity of interactions between these microbes is really the food for the future. Like, we really don't understand much at all. And we know that these communities are complete when they are really diversified. What I am certain about is that this queendom of organisms has a bright future, right? We are creating massive debris fields as the extreme weather events bring us devastation of crops and buildings and toxic sites. So the fungi will be very busy for a long time healing all of those and breaking down those compounds. Let's give them another opportunity to help us heal the soil and do it quickly so that we can see a bright future for all organisms and humans and our grandchildren within our lifetimes.
Amazing. So we have one last question, and we ask all of our guests this. This is also open to our listeners. So if you have an answer for this, we would love to hear what you think. And so please email us or put them in the comment section below. And Sue, I think this question is going to be pretty easy for you. Maybe it was the first time I met you in person, but at the Radical Mycology Convergence, you were leading a mushroom ceremony. And so I think you, and then I heard you speak again at Hampshire College and talking about conversing with mushrooms. So this is a question on that line. If mushrooms had the mic and could tell 1 to 2 sentences to the entire human race, what would they say?
Well, as you know, I lead a lot of shamanic drum journeys to go visit the fungi and listen to what they have to say. I'm thinking it's individual for specific circumstances, but the biggest message I hear them saying, is stop thinking of us as the lowly organisms of rot and decay and slime, which is the mycophobia we know of historically, and begin to embrace our potential. We have been on the planet for 1.7 billion years. We know how to do about everything. And so just open your eyes and listen, and we will guide you. It's not going to be hard. Trust.
Well, you heard it from the fungi. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and thanks, Sue, for joining us and talking about how we can totally revitalize the planet and our sacred relationship with all species and be in complete symbiosis. So thanks so much for tuning in, and everyone, go check out Sue Van Hook and the amazing work that she's doing. And if you get a chance to see her speak in person, I definitely highly recommend it. And as always, much love, and may the spores be with you.